welcome to We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Yeah. And we just got into our chairs. But you know what?
I've been here on time.
We are already. We're talking about superheroes, so we were real clear this. Well, I guess it's afternoon now. We are not superheroes.
No. I couldn't get my cape fastened right.
Yeah, that's why we're.
Then I slammed it in the car door.
That's why we were late. Just,
yeah.
That's exactly why. Okay, that's our story. We're sticking to it. So, our sponsor this hour,
Team Power. Team Power is a local John Deere Kubota dealer, and if you need a tractor or you need tractor service or parts, just give them a call, 226-9226. They're in Shasta Lake City, right off of I-5 on Twinview Boulevard, 3119 Twinview, just south of Phil's Propeller, and they do everything tractors. Or you can get them on the web at readingtractors.com.
What a great web address.
Yeah,
who made that up?
Yeah, I don't know who did that.
Oh, my gosh. So, you can find archives for us, contact information, all sorts of good stuff at wethepeopleradio.us. And we're not going to drag our feet because we have a fun guest today and we have never spoken with him before. So, we're going to learn all sorts of new things. And what a timely topic. Our guest is Travis Smith. He's the associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Concordia University. And he's authored a new book called Superhero Ethics. And thought, what a...
Am I in it?
Yeah, Travis, just ignore that.
Yeah, sorry.
So just great timing on that, because there, for one, there's a whole bunch of superhero stuff out there. It used to be kind of a kid's thing, and it's very much not a kid's thing anymore. Lots of movies, television series, all those things. And I really like the premise of your book, and I won't blow it because I don't know how you like to introduce it. So welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Aaron. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for coming on.
I'm doing great today. I'm really happy to be on We the People Radio.
Well, thanks. This is a very timely topic, ethics, I guess, and superheroes, a great combination. So what prompted this?
Yeah, the book Superhero Ethics, it's sort of two words in the title, one that sounds sort of light and maybe even frivolous to some people, and the other one that sounds serious. And so I teach political theory at Concordia University, and I have always enjoyed superhero stories since I first saw the Super Friends on Saturday morning cartoons. And I had the opportunity to write a book looking at these pop culture phenomena from a perspective that allows me to draw on the various ancient and modern traditions that I teach to my students at the school.
That sounds like a fun course.
Well, I try to make sure that when I'm teaching my students that I take the old ideas and arguments in the books that I teach and try to make them relevant and familiar, and popular culture examples really help me do that. And given the popularity of superhero movies these days, I can trust pretty much everybody in the room knows who Iron Man is, for example. So if he's useful in order to illustrate a point, I can use him as an example. And in the book, I've decided not just to sort of target a student audience, but sort of the general public in which people enjoy these movies, and some people might want to think philosophically about the entertainment that they enjoy, even if it's just usually regarded as popcorn amusements, or if you're the kind of person who thinks a lot about ethical questions and what kind of role models we should give our children and those kinds of questions, and you want to wonder, well, what does the popular culture say about these things today, then my book gives us some places, starting points to think about those questions.
Oh, interesting. When did the book come out?
The book just came out last month in June.
Oh, okay, so we're cutting edge.
Yep, it's still brand new to me.
All right, outstanding. And so what types of characters do you use as examples in the book?
It's one of the things. I don't know if you've ever seen an episode of The Big Bang Theory.
Oh, yeah.
But, comic book fans are renowned for, their pride they have and their knowledge of obscurities and trying to outdo each other with their familiarity of minutiae. And I decided not to go that direction with the book. I didn't fill the book full of inside baseball and things that only people who've read 10,000 comic books or more could understand. I decided to focus in this book on the sort of most well-known to the general public superheroes, the ones that have been in multiple movies over the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And one so that so long as you've got passing familiarity with them, I can offer some, you know, details that maybe you haven't been, maybe you aren't aware of. But I wanted to make sure that it was accessible to people who just have, you know, relative familiarity with the characters on the basis of their, you know, exposure on the silver screen. And so I deal with characters like the Hulk and Wolverine and Iron Man and Captain America and Superman and Batman and Thor, Green Lantern, characters that have been in movies recently at the time that I sort of decided to, when I figured out how to structure the book a few years ago.
Interesting. Yeah, the only thing I really know about superheroes is what I've seen in movies, and we have a fellow that goes to our church that is the spitting image of Stan Lee, so...
Well, Stan Lee appears in all the superhero movies.
Yes, he does.
Once it seems, maybe he appears in your congregation as well.
It could be.
We always see him at church, and so you know, under our breath, we're all, "Hi, Stan Lee."
Have you asked him to say "Excelsior"?
I should.
I'm gonna walk across the aisle. Excuse me.
Face front, true believers. See how he does with that one.
Yeah, I've threatened to secretly take a picture of him and put it on the web and ask people, "Who is this?" And I swear it would come back Stanley.
It was Stanley.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, we laugh every time. But
I had a professor as an undergraduate whose name was Barry Allen, which is the name of the Flash that people know more than they used to on account of the television series. And so as college students, we all, of course, never called him Professor Allen. We all called him the Flash.
The Flash. Once you get the handle, you're never going to lose it.
Yeah, he was one of my favorite teachers as an undergraduate.
So you were destined to write the book.
Yeah.
Well, kind of interesting because they do have, they are held to a higher standard. And it's something that has kind of fallen away in our society. I like the premise, like, can superheroes make us better in real life? You know, not just, you know, entertain us in our free time.
Well, right. I mean, I focus on questions of ethics. You know, what kind of character should a person have if they want to live a happy life and if they want to be a responsible individual and a good contributor to the well-being of their community? Those kinds of old-fashioned questions that multiple traditions have endeavored to answer. And you know, superheroes are among the first places that, you know, young children are exposed to these questions of, you know, who should I look up to? Who should I try to imitate? What does it mean to do the right thing? And what are the struggles that are involved in doing the right thing? And so superheroes offer a sort of a good place to start asking these questions ourselves, especially nowadays where it's not just young children, elementary school age, watching Super Friends on Saturday morning cartoon who are enjoying them, but people of all ages, whether they're taking their children, their grandchildren to go see them or just to go see them themselves with their friends because they enjoy them. And so I think that superheroes are useful that way because just like, you know, the heroes that any society has, whether it's in the ancient Greek society with their Achilles and their Odysseus, in pretty much any society, we have our heroes or concepts of heroism that are sometimes reflections of who we think we are at our best, or perhaps images of who we wish we could be if only we were better than we are. And so these are, you know, permanent, perennial questions of interest to human beings across all cultures, and these seem to be the ones that right now, all over children's lunchboxes and Halloween costumes and so on, are the ones that are the characters that are most prominent in our culture today here.
Interesting. We have to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back with our guest. Oops. I just broke my laptop. I was just going to read a little blurb that I had there on you, and I can't do that now, so we'll do that when we come back.
Sure thing, Adam. Thank you.
We're talking to Travis Smith, and we'll be back in 1 minute.
Yeah, hang on for the extra information. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? What do they want? What shall we do about them? What do they want? What shall we do about them? What do they want? What shall we do about them? What do they want?
Woke up this morning, what did I see? A big black cloud hanging over me. I switched on the radio and nearly dropped dead. The news was so bad that I fell out of bed. There was a gas strike, oil strike, lorry strike, a bed strike. Gotta be a Superman to survive. The gas bills, rent bills, tax bills, phone bills. I'm such a wreck, but I'm staying alive.
You do have to be a Superman to survive these days. So, Travis, do you work more with the old characters or the new ones, like the ones that are in movies or the ones who've been kind of comics only?
No, so the book, I focus on the characters that are, I think the newest character mentioned in the book is Wolverine, and he was introduced in the mid-70s. So I worked with characters that are well-established, familiar to people who have not been lifelong comic book readers, but still are aware of the popular ones from movies and cartoons. I'm more than happy to, I don't know, Aaron, I don't know how familiar you are with the more obscure characters. If you want to push me on anything, I could get into a few of them.
I was looking at this. It was a little list that I think it was part of the, I don't know, book jacket or something I pulled that mm-hmm. I posted online here, and it said, like, how can we overcome our beastly nature and preserve our humanity? And it was the Hulk versus Wolverine. But I don't know a lot about Wolverine, so
okay.
I was wondering if that was an old one or a new one.
That's fairly recent.
Yeah, Hugh Jackman has done an amazing job of bringing the character of Wolverine to life on many movies now. I don't know how many there have been. It's probably almost 10 now. And he was a character that I remember in 2000, when the first X-Men movie came out, comic book fans, we were skeptical. We didn't think that Wolverine was a character that any real-life person could pull off and be both believable and not hokey, but Hugh Jackman proved us all wrong. And the movie called Logan, which was the last major feature starring him, that came out last year in 2017, is, in my mind, one of the top three superhero movies of all time. And the simple way to sell it to people who maybe don't care much for superheroes but are interested in questions of ethics and religion and so forth, that movie, Logan, is effectively the superhero version of the Book of Exodus. So they, you know, the movies have, you know, some of them anyways, have really show off that if you're familiar with various traditions of thought and faith, that these stories are grounded in those. And that movie in particular did a great job of working with, say, classic source material and giving it a fresh interpretation for today.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier about their struggle with their character, you know, what's right and wrong, and their own personal fight with who they are and how to deal with it and how to do the right thing versus the, you know, the vengeful thing. And I think that's a...
Yeah, there is always that dark side.
Yeah, and that's...
Oh, no, there's a big dark side to the character of Wolverine, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Two things about what you're asking me there, Bill. In the book, I know that I'm working with fantastical characters with out-of-this-world abilities and unrealistic storylines. And so what I try to do is I try to humanize the characters and ask, you know, if we read them metaphorically, how do they resemble the kinds of people we actually know in the world and the kind of motivations that people actually have and the kinds of difficulties that ordinary people face in their everyday lives. And I read them that way to see how we can apply the stories or, appreciate the characters from that perspective rather than seeing them as just mythological beings far above ordinary humanity and therefore not really relevant to us. And Hulk, the Hulk-Wolverine chapter that Aaron mentioned, I think is particularly relevant these days because it seems to me that a number of parties in our political discourse today seem to be engaging in and recommending and even championing incivility in public life.
Right.
And the Hulk and Wolverine are the characters that represent rage and represent the desire to protect one's own identity group, and you know, they both have sort of "how dare you" responses to the world that result in them lashing out in violent ways in order to stand up for themselves or to stand up for the group that they claim to represent. And so, insofar as those kinds of motivations are something we see in the daily news cycle, you know, very regularly now, it seems to me, if you want to ask, you know, what kind of superheroes are the ones that are most like the people who are saying, leave me alone or else, or don't offend me or else, or don't offend the people I care about or else. My chapter on Hulk and Wolverine is intended to explore what kinds of motivations people have when they behave that way and think that way, and whether or not it's possible for people to behave in an uncivilized way and yet still do it honorably, or is that combination impossible? Is it possible to behave in what seems like an uncivilized way and yet keep it under control, or is it always bound to get out of control? And so there's my best pitch right now, given what seems to be on our news feeds and our scrolls on our screens so regularly today, the kind of thing that in the book I try to discuss by looking at these popular culture figures.
Do you find that the recent, I would term the more recent superheroes, say the X-Men, the message in those movies a lot of times is related to current events and, how Hollywood would respond to certain things and certain attitudes more so than the early superheroes that were, you know, fighting for good and justice, or the X-Men, or the more recent superheroes have more of a cultural message.
That's interesting. Give me a second to think about that, Bill. I think it is the case. One of the reasons that I was able to use the more classic characters for the purposes I put them to in the book is that they are sort of more archetypal. They do represent, certain fundamentally recognizable, identifiable personality types. Mm-hmm. And problems that that all societies, all human societies, tend to struggle with in one way or another, and aren't just particular to, 21st century America now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why they have such lasting power, and that's why they have to, in their storytelling, they're constantly making adjustments for whatever's new, so Captain America is getting angry at the Nixon administration in some stories, and then he's getting upset at the Reagan administration and a little while later, and then he gets used as his stories get used as a way to make comments on America Today more recently. That happens, but it's because the core of the character, one of the things I try to work with in the book are the sort of the ethical cores of the character that are beneath the whatever is the passing issue of the day concern that might lead itself to ideological messaging. The characters that are the ones that last are these ones that have these ethical cores that are more fundamental and recognizable and essential.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always been the case that, even dating back to the earliest stories of Superman and Batman, that they're always also commenting on the issues and the politics of the day. And so these are characters that have always had both in sort of an anchor in permanent questions and concerns, while also addressing what's on people's minds right now in order to keep them interesting. Sometimes they do introduce characters or stories that are very narrowly focused on a very specific issue of the day. And of course, they can be regarded as, really relevant, but often the ones that are most ideologically focused on a particular issue of the day are also the ones that don't date well.
Right. Yeah, because if you look at the early, the early Superman stories, I mean, he dealt with communism, the Nazis. I mean, he fought a lot of what we perceived as villainous characters back in the day. Today's Superman is now fighting you know.
And he also struggled with family and where he came from, and was he a person or was he not a person, and,
right.
you know, how did...
But they have updated it. I mean, now he's fighting,
right.
you know...
The actual battles.
You know, villains from outer space and, you know, more modern villainous characters. But the message, I think, is the same. It's the same struggle, you know, what's right and what's wrong and how should we react. I mean, do you find that to be the case?
Yeah, I mean, Superman being the first of the sort of great superheroes invented in modern American comic book literature is about the most complete character there is. If you were to read
mm-hmm.
you know, the complete catalog of Superman stories and watch all the TV shows and all the movies, pretty much everything is addressed. Every aspect of the human condition, from the smallest ordinary concerns to the most cosmic, catastrophic threats, everything.
Right.
Superman deals with everything along the way. His relationship with Lois Lane, his relationship with Perry White at the Daily Planet, his troubled relationship with Lex Luthor, not to mention his fellow Justice Leaguers, including his best friend Batman. They give a sort of comedy tragedy duo, like the old theatrical masks working together. I don't know if I'd want to oversimplify the complexity of those stories, but it is the case that there are certain themes that remain fundamental to Superman's stories. I was having a conversation just yesterday. I presented my book at the Comic-Con in Montreal yesterday, and one of my colleagues, a professor at McGill University, was emphasizing how Superman represents hope.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
And in my book, I talk about how Superman, my way of putting it is Superman represents the hope specifically that not that might makes right. Might makes right is, of course, a Machiavellian villainous perspective. What I say Superman represents is that Superman represents the hope that right makes might. The idea that if only we always do the right thing, right? If we live with hope, and we always are resolved to make our very best effort to stand up for what's right and come to the aid of others who are in need of assistance, that a society that's based on doing that, on being just rather than unjust, on respecting people's rights rather than trampling over them, that society will in the end work out to be also the most powerful society. It will be the leader in the world. It'll be the society that's the most prosperous, in which people have the most freedom and the ability to enjoy life as much as possible. So if you ever, you know, have the hope that morality yields success in life, individually or collectively, Superman is sort of the superhero model more than any of the others to represent that faith.
Right, right. We got to take a break, but I want to stay on that vein because it's interesting. The right makes might makes right, and the good guy will always come out in the end. So
yeah, and I like that part.
Yeah, that's...
We've kind of grown up with that. Without that, things kind of don't make sense. We'll be back with our guest, Travis Smith. He has written a book called Superhero Ethics. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You call me strong, you call me weak, but still your secrets I will keep. Took for granted all the times I never let you down. Stumble in and bump your head. If not for me, then you'd be dead. I fix you up, put you back on solid ground. If I go crazy, then will you still call me Superman? If I'm alive and well, don't you be there holding my hand? I'll keep you by my side with my superhuman might, kryptonite.
Welcome back.
We're talking to Travis Smith, and we're talking about superheroes in and superhero ethics
In the new book he wrote. And Travis, you know, one thing about superheroes that I think we find in today's, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but you know, superheroes today, they don't always do the right thing, but in the end, they make it right. And that's kind of different from the original superheroes that seem to always do the right thing. And is that kind of a reflection of our culture today?
Yeah, that's interesting. It is the case that, of course, like all the heroic and tragic figures in classical literature, in order for a character to be interesting, they need to be flawed.
Right.
Right? One of the things, we mentioned Superman before the break, and sometimes people criticize for Superman in particular for not having enough flaws. You know, he has hardships in his, you know, fictional life, but not many flaws. Spider-Man is somebody who also always struggles to do the right thing because one time in his life he didn't do that, and it turned out to have tragic consequences. But in Spider-Man's case, doing the right thing doesn't always yield success. Lots of times Spider-Man does the right thing, and then things go badly anyway. So that speaks to part of the human condition as well. But I think I remember growing up in the 70s and 80s, an increasing number of characters that time were flawed in a sort of deeper way, I think in the sense that you're referring to, where maybe their willingness to cut corners or the means by which they fought for justice themselves were morally questionable, were more popular. So characters like Wolverine, which we discussed before, or the Punisher became popular.
Right.
Although, I think if you even go back to characters like Iron Man, who's been around since the early days of Marvel Comics, you know, he starts off as an arms dealer, and his morality is always kind of, you know, he's more about technological progress than he is about anything else. And technological progress is morally ambiguous. You know, how good is it? We have good intentions to, you know, reduce suffering and to, you know, satisfy our appetites, but there are any number of morally questionable activities that we engage in either in the scientific research or that we get used to in our lives when scientific products, technological products are in our hands. And so the superhero stories aren't always going to be presenting an ideal of the very perfect. In order for them to be relatable to us, and in order for us to see ourselves reflected in them and then maybe weigh whether or not certain kinds of decisions are admirable or certain ways of life are praiseworthy, they should, you know, reflect our imperfections as well. And there can be some moral ambiguity in them that allows us to have some critical, you know, to think critically about them and not just assume that because they're portrayed as a hero, therefore they must be perfectly good. And that's one of the things I do in superhero ethics in my book, is I don't just praise the characters. I don't just simply accept them as heroic because, you know, they call themselves superheroes. I mean, think about that, right? How ridiculous it would be in the real world for someone to actually go around and saying, I'm a superhero.
Yeah.
And it's almost ridiculous for anybody just to go around and saying, I'm a hero. You might raise an eyebrow if you did that, but I'm a superhero? I mean, that would be something to raise two eyebrows at.
Yeah, they all spend a lot of time hiding the superhero-ness, at least the ones I'm thinking of. You know, they it's like, kind of don't look over here. You know, I'm not really that special.
Yeah, I think in a lot of the cases they try to lead a normal life.
Well, a lot of them have fake names. Like, you know, Superman was a, you know, fake newspaper guy.
Clark Kent. Yeah.
Yeah, he ran into phone booths all the time. I mean, they're not marching around in there.
No, that's an interesting point about the technology too. I mean, in today's world, I think a lot of people would say that, you know, life is much more complicated today, and so I think that's reflected in the superhero stories as well. Is your character is much more complicated as a result of the different technologies and issues of the day.
They weave in a lot of politics too. I notice in a lot of them that are series based. They have you know, corruption, the mayor, or, you know, whatever fictional town they live in has some sort of, you know, obviously, you know, you don't have very good superheroes without villains. But a lot of times the villains are people that are the regular people, but they have all the power. They have, you know, quote, all the societal power. And these guys use their ability to try to kind of get that away from them or get rid of them or replace them.
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't need people to encourage us to be just if injustice weren't so tempting. We wouldn't need people to fight for justice if there wasn't injustice all around us. On the question of whether or not things are more complicated, I certainly agree that if anything makes life in the 21st century specifically different is sort of the rapid development of new technologies that really get ahead of our capacity to figure out whether or not it's prudent or not to be using them, or whether or not it's responsible, or whether or not it's going to lead to our own happiness. You know, whether or not, I tend to be the kind of person that thinks you probably shouldn't put young children on the internet with, you know, social media pages and become addicts of Facebook and et cetera. Whatever uses they might have that are positive and constructive for all kinds of people, I don't want to put my own young child on those. I don't think that would be healthy for his mental development. So technological issues are new. But all right, these are questions that are not, the questions I'm dealing with in the book are not just new to us now, although the question of technology I deal with in the Iron Man chapter and the Batman chapters particularly, because they're the ones who are most technologically, whose character is most tied up with technology. But as I said, I draw on multiple traditions in order to discuss the superheroes. And I mean, even when Plato wrote The Republic, the first great work of political philosophy, one of the fundamental questions in the book was how come nobody has the argument that tells all of us why we should always do the right thing? Because wouldn't it be handy if we had that? If we had that argument and everyone would go, yep, you're right, that's the reason why nobody should ever do the wrong thing, the world would be a different place. But they didn't have that argument then, and we don't have that argument today, even though we all sort of wish we did.
Oh, I think today it is like, I mean, in the past, I mean, you have bad people and you have that do bad things, and you have good people that oftentimes do bad things, and that's kind of society's struggle right there. Is everybody looks at, geez, should I do this or not? And you know.
Well, and then the danger is that, you know, we take certain classes of people and, you know, since we're talking about politics, you know, everyone in politics is corrupt, you know, and that's silly because, I mean, you just, the odds on that would never pan out. Jimmy the Greek wouldn't take that bet. You're going to accidentally have good people sneak in no matter what you do. I really liked your, the second point too, I was hoping you could talk about was how far can we rely on our willpower and our imagination to improve the human condition. And you had that with Iron Man and Green Lantern. And I don't know the Green Lantern guy well enough, but the question is certainly valid.
Okay, yeah.
And timely.
Sure thing, Aaron. So Iron Man, who Robert Downey Jr. has brought to life in the last 10 years on the big screen. And one of the things as a comic book fan, it was interesting to think back that before the first Iron Man movie, unless you were a serious comic book reader, you didn't know much about that character. But thanks to Robert Downey Jr., Iron Man is somebody who's a cornerstone of popular culture today. So it's amazing how these characters that have been around for a long time, but sort of in the background or in the niche markets in popular culture, can all of a sudden become so well known to everybody, more or less. Green Lantern had a movie that flopped about a decade ago, but he's been around in comic books since World War II, of different versions of the character, so he's been one of my favorites. He was my favorite watching Saturday morning cartoons in the 70s. And in the chapter that you refer to, I talk about how sometimes people think that if only we had enough imagination, and if we had enough resolve, and if we had enough material resources, then if we had those three things, we could do anything, and we could get everything that we wanted, and we could solve all of our problems. And so all that we're missing in life is that we maybe aren't imaginative enough, or maybe we don't try hard enough, or maybe we just aren't as well off materially in terms of wealth as we could be. But if only we had more imagination, more resolve, more means at our disposal, we could do everything, get everything, solve everything. And in different ways, whether it's because some people wish and hope and think that maybe technology is going to save us, all the evils of the human condition, it's only a matter of time before the singularity happens or something, and then almost as if by magic, all disease will be gone, all poverty will be gone, all conflicts can be resolved.
Well, that's when the government takes over everything. That's how we solve everything. We just give it all over to the government. They'll run it all. It'll all be better. We won't have to worry our pretty little heads about that.
Yeah, there'll be no more struggle.
Yeah,
you're right. The other side of it isn't just technology, but there are some people who have sort of revolutionary ideas about politics.
It's all,
right?
It's all only... our free choice. It's all that stupid free choice. If we got these, you know, if we stopped having dummies electing dummies, right, and we just let the, the people who really know things, if we just put them in charge, we'd be... there was a movement around the turn of the century, last century, called technocracy. We've had a guest on several times talking about that, and it's funny to think you could fill the Hollywood Bowl in the 1920s with people who thought that technology would take over everything. And you think about what kind of technology they had, it's like, wow.
Yeah, they were compared to what we have today.
Yeah, they were the dark ages,
but they really did.
But they thought that
forward.
If we put experts in charge of everything and we stopped doing like all this, you know, we go to the polling place and elect people who aren't experts. We put the scientists in charge of the world.
Yeah. You know, and some of those ideas do date back to even, you know, Plato's Republic is the first sort of attempt to sort of outline what a technocracy might look like. And of course, in the 20th century to today, lots of sci-fi dystopias are there. How many Star Trek episodes did Captain Kirk and the gang find a planet where robots and computers had been programmed to rule everybody?
And it was a perfect society.
It turns out.
Yeah, they all wear the same clothes. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Travis Smith. We're not going to have enough time. This is a fun topic. It's nice to
Thanks, Aaron. Nice
to look at politics from a different lens. Lovely. You're listening to We the People.
The Bowery got his bumps. 42nd Street got Big Jim Walker. He a bull shooting son of a gun. Yeah, he's big and dumb as a man can come. But he's stronger than a country horse. And when the bad folks all get together at night, you know they all call Big Jim Ball just because. And they say you don't tug on Superman's cape. You don't spit into the wind. You don't pull a mask off an old Lone Ranger. And you don't mess around with Jim. I don't do that.
Just out to find the better part of me. I'm more than a bird, I'm more than a plane, I'm more than some pretty face beside a train. And it's not easy to be me. I wish that I could cry, fall upon my knees, find a way to lie about a home I'll never see. It may sound absurd, but don't be naive. Even heroes have the right to bleed. I may be disturbed, but won't you concede? Even heroes have the right to dream. It's not easy to be me.
A lot of pressure there.
There you go. The Superheroes Lament. That's what made us hearty. I found that song at the last minute. I'm like, oh, this one's too good to skip. Okay, so What have we missed? What have we not told people, besides the fact that you have a great article in the Daily Caller that we have posted online for you?
Thanks so much. That actually speaks to one of the points that was raised in the previous segment about sort of the attitudes that some people have toward politics today, in which, so sometimes in superhero movies, you see the kind of movies where the characters are fighting some sort of threat to the whole world or maybe even the whole galaxy, and you need these super-powered individuals with extraordinary minds and abilities to come to the rescue of all humankind because we ordinary folk aren't up to it. We can only stand on the sidelines and ooh and awe and cheer and be afraid, and otherwise we need these extraordinary individuals to be our champions, to come to our rescue. And that kind of attitude you can see, and thinking analogously, is similar to, or that kind of situation is similar to the attitude that some people have, that politics is something that ends up being entrusted to people that we imagine to be super smart or super competent in various ways, and therefore we delegate all authority to them to come to the rescue and try to eradicate injustice or whatever threats there are to our community, because we ordinary individuals are helpless and victims that couldn't possibly be responsible for ourselves and our communities because we're at the mercy of vast impersonal forces, and therefore we need these super heroic type, super powerful people to do it for us. And in the article that you mentioned in the Daily Caller, I raised this as somewhat concerning. It's not really the American tradition, to be frank, in which, you know, we're not just consumers and producers, but we're citizens with responsibilities and not just rights. And in order for our community to thrive, it's incumbent on citizens to, in a civilized fashion, participate in the rough and tumble business of working together for the common good. And it's not something simply to entrust to super powerful individuals or people we hope will prove super powerful on our behalf if only we give them enough power.
and that's true too, because there is that danger to kind of sit on the sidelines, and yet that isn't our nature.
Do you think that stems from again kind of a cultural thing we've fallen into of a lot of dependence? We depend on our parents, and then we depend on our boss, and then we depend on, you know, our local government. It just seems like in the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years, that there's been more and more of folks that have become dependent.
It gets more complicated, right?
Yeah.
So we're all busy.
Somehow, yeah, we want somebody else
somehow
to
somehow the technology has made
manage,
our lives more complicated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm someone who thinks that it's part of the human condition, that we're all capable of independence, but we also always remain dependent. None of us are, you know, individuals that are, how did the old Simon and Garfunkel song go? Rocks and islands, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not like that.
Right.
We live in webs of interdependence in our societies. The question is, and the ethical question that I address in the book, actually, in Superhero Ethics, is how do we deal with both the fact that in order for somebody to live well and be happy, we need to learn personal and interpersonal responsibility. We have to learn to take care of ourselves, and we need to learn to take care of those we care about and our communities. And it's also the case that nobody in the superhero world is the Hulk. The Hulk just wants to be left alone. One of the Hulk says, Hulk just wants to be left alone, but puny humans keep bothering Hulk, so Hulk has to smash them. Hulk is a representation of somebody who wants to be totally independent, but that's not human. The human condition is one that mixes dependence and independence, and the ethical question is what kind of behaviors do we exhibit? How do we actually treat each other? How do we actually work together in order to both take care of ourselves individually and collectively? And I think what you're pointing out there is that there is an increasing tendency, especially as society gets so vast and so much is at stake and it's so complicated and we feel powerless and hopeless, that we're more likely to point to look for what gets called sometimes collective responsibility,
right?
Which is a way usually of saying I don't want to take responsibility for it, but other people will do it for me. But I don't want to seem so irresponsible, so we'll call it collective responsibility. But usually, that just means entrusting responsibility to some few people to do it all for us, and that's not really consistent with the American traditions, rightly understood, either. I don't think, but it is a human temptation. I mean, if you read the writings of the American founders, that they knew that these are fundamental human temptations, and keep maintaining a free society. It's an experiment, and it's not sure it'll last. Because there's something in us that would often rather delegate responsibility or entrust power to others rather than learn to exercise it responsibly ourselves.
Yeah, and do you think a lot of that comes from just being or turning to be more of a world community than, you know, kind of a local community? You hear so much now in the media, everything is a worldview. And so naturally it makes it much more complicated.
And you have to add in what he was mentioning earlier, the people that, you know, we have this call to, you know, everyone needs to be angry all the time. And you get buried in this angriness that you hear from people all the time. I just don't even want to turn on the news anymore. I don't pay attention to any of that. It's too overwhelming.
I don't tend to watch the news on television much either. I'll usually just end up screaming at the screen. and you're right, though. One of the things is, it seems like there's never a story on the news that doesn't lead the journalist to ask this question. Are you ready for it? You've heard it before. What can the federal government do to solve this problem?
Right.
Is that one?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think here's what the relevance of our localities and our interpersonal relationships, that never goes away. That's fundamentally human. But you can imagine that that there are those who are going to be benefited by our thinking that things can only be taken care of at the global level or the national level, especially those who want to wield the most powerful most power at those levels. They want us to entrust the power to them on our behalf, of course. They only have our best interests at heart, I'm sure.
But it's somewhat frightening that we have people who will call, like, our local congressional office, for instance, and they want Congress to deal with, like, a local political issue or a local child, you know, child issue, something that really...
Yeah, another the federal government has to come
in and it's like, you know, you really don't want that to happen.
No, you don't want that.
Travis, we are flat out of time here.
Well, the time flew by real fast.
It did. We'd love to have you back on, though.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, we wish we could do this for another hour with you. We've been speaking with Travis Smith. He's the associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Concordia and author of the new book, Superhero Ethics. We hope you'll go get it because I think you'll like it. Thanks, Travis. You can find all the information at wethepeopleradio.us. The second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor.
Yeah, Bill's all, don't forget I have to do the sponsor.
Well, yeah, that's kind of important. I mean, you know. They,
and then he looks at me like,
I pay the bill.
Why are you not saying anything?
That's right. Our sponsor this this hour is Team Power, our local Kubota and John Deere tractor dealer in Shasta Lake, California. They're the all-round tractor guys. I mean, if you need a tractor, you need service on your tractor or mower, or you need parts, go see them. They're at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, or you can find them on the web at readingtractors.com. But, yeah, they can do it all. Give them a call, 226-9226. Team Power.
Ta-da!
Yeah, there you go.
Lovely. Okay, so we've had a little change of plans. We were originally going to run an archive because I was sick last week and I didn't plan the second half. But we were having so much fun talking to Travis Smith. We've shanghaied him for another hour, so he will be our hostage for the full program.
There you go.
There were just tons of things we skipped over and wanted to ask, but I knew the time was running out. So the only bad part is we're going to have to play the same music again. But I like the song, so hopefully that works for everybody. There were just so there are so many things in both the book and the article that we didn't talk about. So anyway, what was the one thing I was going to ask you? Oh yeah, we were looking. I was looking again at that list, the timeless questions that were posed. I don't know by the publisher, or I don't. Maybe it's on the book jacket. I haven't seen that yet, but it said, "What limits do we have to observe when protecting our neighborhood from crime and corruption?" And I thought, our town. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's everybody's town, but in California anyway, with you know letting all these prisoners out early and all this kind of stuff, we're just inundated. I mean, yeah. It's kind of like.
Kind of like Gotham.
Night of the Living Dead. Yeah. I mean, last night, driving home from church, it's like, okay, you had, zombies down this alley. You had some guy sacked out on someone's porch. I mean, we're not in a big city. We're 90,000 people here.
Well, it's becoming more and more the same case everywhere.
Yeah, it's just starting to look like hell. And same too with San Francisco now. They're canceling conferences because it's so messed up. So this idea of protecting neighborhoods from crime and corruption, and you have, it has here, it says Batman versus Spider-Man. So I'm kind of curious, what's your take on that?
Okay, I'm glad to be back for the second hour, Aaron. I feel, however, I should let your audience know that I'm being kept chained to a chair, and I put out a message on my Superman signal.
Hey, you said you weren't going to say anything about that.
We love a good hostage. We love a good hostage taking.
So yes, right. I discussed Superman and Batman. It was funny that you bring this up because at the end of the first hour, we were talking about the world community perspective on politics, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I do mention in the book in Superhero Ethics that sometimes people say, I'm not just an American, I'm a global citizen. You've heard that before?
Yes. Oh, sure.
Yeah, and people take pride in not being patriotic, as if somehow there's something objectionable about being patriotic because, you know, America's not perfect and it's flawed, and therefore having some sort of allegiance to something that transcends America, the whole world, all humanity is perceived as more noble or more moral. You've heard that perspective before?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the thing is, though, the idea of a global citizen, if you parse the words, is something of a contradiction in terms. You can't be a citizen on that scale. To be a citizen means to actually be personally, actively involved in the public business. It means to actually have to work with other citizens in order to achieve goods consistent with your values and argue with people and have to make compromises with people in order to make your community better. And if we have a hard enough time doing that at the level of the whole nation, and sometimes we have a hard enough time doing that at the level of the state, like California, I'm sure it's difficult. Can you imagine how difficult it would be to try to do that as a citizen of the whole world? You could be absolutely sure that none of us would have any real say in anything. Nobody would have a voice, or the most voice anybody would have would be what a lot of us seem to be reduced to now, the kind of people who say, you know, I'm a good citizen. I've been busy today retweeting all of the correct hashtags. Right?
Right.
So long as you're saying the right things on social media and getting angry at the bad guys, then you're a good citizen. But that really falls short of what citizens.
Well, I think that the EU is a classic example of that. I mean, it was a great what they thought was a great idea, but it's failing because people are realizing they don't really have a say in their local economies, in their local government. That they're being basically ruled by a small number of upper class unelected officials, and they have to go along with it. And
that's right. Sovereign self-government is something to be defended, but doing that requires a degree of effort because
it's
always
work.
People who are happy to take it away from you and claim that they're doing it for your own good because they're the ones who really know and they'll be your heroes.
Mm-hmm. No,
there's always going to be people who will be happy to step up and claim that they're the super heroic ones if only you let them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how frightening is that?
Well, we're seeing.
Go ahead, Aaron. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so, right, the chapter on Spider-Man and Batman looks at two heroes who are most known for how they handle things at the city level. Batman and Gotham City, mm-hmm. right? That's his microcosm for the whole world, in a sense. And Spider-Man, who, you know, lives in Queens and swings his webs back and forth to Manhattan every day. You know, he calls himself your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. I don't know how last time you've been to New York, but that seems, you know, Queens to Manhattan still seems like a pretty big neighborhood.
Yeah, that's a fairly large swing, but it'd be so much easier than the bridge.
But still, the emphasis on neighborhood is sort of smaller than the level of a whole city. And so I talk about those characters in part about looking at how you engage with people in your communities as an ethical person at a level that's lower than the political, where our relationships are not merely determined by considerations of power and imposition, and not great power. I mean, obviously, there's, you know, anyone who's participated in local politics will tell you there's lots of power plays going on, but where you're engaged with your community face to face. And it's not sort of your distant relationship with a massive, impenetrable government. What I hear these days on talk radio being referred to as the swamp, somewhere far away, right? And of course, this is something that seems to be disappearing in a lot of people's lives. But Spider-Man, in particular, represents what it means to be. A good person in the context of your immediate locality or community. Batman, however, looks at it from the point of view of sort of intolerance toward any injustice, as if the whole world and our whole society needs to be fixed. It's not just merely a matter of doing what you can day in, day out. Here's a big difference between Spider-Man and Batman. Spider-Man goes on patrol once in a while, on occasion, when he can. And if he sees something going on that's not right, he goes and steps in and tries to help out the people who are in danger. Batman dedicates himself around the clock. He doesn't seem to sleep. He wants to stamp out injustice, and he's motivated by some deeply buried anger and desire for vengeance, and he wants to end all injustice. Spider-Man, because he's a bit less monomaniacal about it, still has a sense of humor. Spider-Man is famous for cracking jokes all the time, and in order to crack jokes in the face of injustice, as Spider-Man does, you need to kind of be aware of the fact that injustice is a permanent fact of the human condition that we are always struggling against. But if you allow your anger at the existence of injustice to so control and define you, then you become humorless. And that's how Batman's often depicted. And that's why the Joker is Batman's arch enemy, because laughter is something that you have no toleration. You've seen this in social media, right? People who get really angry at comedy, people who can't stand jokes because jokes are always offensive, and offense is always an insult, and insults are always unjust and therefore wrong, and how dare you laugh?
Yeah, yes. you instantly get classified as the bully if you make a bad joke or a joke somebody is offended by.
Raised in big families, teasing each other and that sort of thing. And who probably were bullies. In the workplace anymore, I had to go to some stupid harassment thing it was like a week ago, and I won't get into the details, but it was humorless. Let's just say it. You know, if you say anything funny, or, you know, you have any kind of, it doesn't have to be off color or weird or creepy. I mean, just being funny at all, or making jokes with your coat, that's all offensive. It was discrimination, harassment, or something else.
Bullying.
You know,
that was like the only choice for everything.
Centuries ago, people would get in trouble for saying the wrong things because it was heretical or blasphemous.
Oh, that's true.
And there'd have to be an inquisition in order to stamp out the people who say the dangerous wrong things, because saying the dangerous wrong things means that whatever kind of evils there are in society, whether material or immaterial, are only going to get worse, and great calamity will be brought down upon the community because some people are saying the wrong things.
Salem witch trials.
And that doesn't seem like it's totally disappeared. disappeared. No, this puritanical drive still seems to be alive, although the particular causes to which it attaches itself do change from time to time.
Yeah, very much like Salem. You know, you don't have to have done anything; you just point the finger. We have to take a really quick break again. Time is speeding by. I was kind of hoping we had a superhero who could slow down time. That would be maybe I could come back as that. We really need that. We're here with our guest, Travis Smith. He's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Concordia University. He's authored a new book called Superhero Ethics, and we also have posted an article that appears in Daily Caller called Can Superheroes Save American Freedom? You can find all that at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Woke up this morning, what did I see? A big black cloud hanging over me. I switched on the radio and nearly dropped dead. The news was so bad that I fell out of bed. There was a gas strike, oil strike, lorry strike, a bread strike. Gotta be a Superman to survive. Gas bills, rent bills, tax bills, phone bills. I'm such a wreck, but I'm staying.
And we're back with our guest, Travis Smith, talking about his book, Superhero Ethics. So, all right, got another one here. Here was another one of the questions on the back of the book. This was Captain America versus Mr. Fantastic. I don't know Mr. Fantastic. I guess I need to get out more. Idea was, will the pursuit of an active life or a contemplative life bring us true fulfillment? And that's obviously a question everybody struggles with.
Is it? Yeah, this is sort of the most sort of classical philosophical question asked directly in the book. In the classical tradition, they would ask, you know, what's the way to happiness? Is the way to happiness just pleasure? Is it just satisfying our appetites, filling our bellies, you know, and whatever else happens to make us feel good, right? Is that the way to happiness? And they said, well, no, that's for animals. Human beings need more and deserve more than just pleasure in order to be happy. We aspire to something higher than that, that mere pleasure won't satisfy us. Even if we had it, we'd be yearning for something better than that. And so the two main alternatives are, do we find happiness in the active life by the things we do in our communities in order to try to be noble, right? To be honorable, to achieve results that we can be proud of in our societies and in our lives. Is that the way, or is it not in the pursuit of the honorable and the glorious, which is what the active life cares about, but is it in the pursuit of truth? Which philosophers and scientists would say is where you don't worry so much about the things of this world like honor and glory. Those are all merely conventional and fleeting. But truth is permanent and eternal. And therefore, if we want to live the best possible life, we should try to pursue the truth at all costs. And that's something that in the classical tradition they said made human beings most like gods, because truth is unchanging like the gods are. So this is one of those sort of problematics that you encounter in a, you know, introductory class to classical thought. And I thought, what if we looked at superheroes and said, who represents these alternatives best? And I said, well, I think Captain America on the one side, who Chris Evans plays in the movies these days and is famous for starting his career by punching Hitler, And Mr. Fantastic is one of the first characters of the modern Marvel Comics age, the leader of the Fantastic Four. Three movies in recent years have been based on that team, and he's appeared in them, but none of them had the same critical acclaim as some of the more recent Marvel movies have. But he's the sort of greatest brain in all of comicdom. I'm sure Lex Luthor would object, and Lex Luthor would say he's smarter than all of them.
Mm-hmm.
But Mr. Fantastic is generally recognized as the smartest person in comic books. So I use him to look at the scientific life, someone pursuing truth through science.
You know, all of these things are, I mean, they've been discussed over the years, but I don't think in this way. What made you think about it in terms of like as superheroes, just because you liked them as a kid?
Well,
I mean, it's there. I mean, you can't watch the movies or have read the comic books as a kid, or follow any of this even tangentially, and not pick up on the fact that the themes are far beyond little kiddie themes. It's not like the old Batman, zap, boom, bang, Mm-hmm. More complicated than that.
The characters are ubiquitous,
yeah.
And the concerns, as I was saying in the first hour, these characters have such staying power because they really do speak very directly. You might even say cartoonishly, but to situations, concerns, qualities that we're all familiar with in our everyday lives. And so they make themselves available. The fact that they are cartoonish and may be perceived as mere juvenile amusements is the kind of thing that makes some people sneer at them and say, that's not serious business. That's kid stuff, right? And at the same time, some people might look at philosophy and say, philosophy is only for snooty, elitist, sophisticated types. And the rest of us who have to have a real job, don't have time, or shouldn't, that's something that's just stargazing. That's just keeping your head in the clouds. And the real world has nothing to do with what the bookworms and the smarty pants have to say. And Superhero Ethics, this book I've written, tries to say let's reject both of those extremes, and let's say that philosophy is something that human beings can engage in, and that it is not irrelevant. There are certain kinds of philosophy that seem more irrelevant to life than others, that's for sure. But part of philosophy is asking these very fundamental questions of human motivation and behavior. That we all actually, in our everyday lives, we have our actions are always guided by motivations that are sometimes explicit and sometimes just assumed, and they're always available for inspection. And once you start examining your motives or the objectives you have in life, you actually start engaging in philosophy. It's not something only for professors and universities. It's something that as soon as you start asking questions seriously about what do I value and what would be good for me, you're already taking the first steps in philosophy. And at the same time, I want to say that superhero stories, even though they've got this tradition, especially thanks to the Batman series from the 1960s that you just referred to as being just campy, silly fun for kids, I say, look, this is like, as I said, this is not much different than asking questions that any society might ask, which is to say, which role models are being put forward in our society, whether fictional or real people? Who is offering themselves up as a model of emulation, as someone I might admire or recommend to my children that they might look up to as exemplary for good behavior to lead to a successful life or a just life? And that's not just for kids. That's something that human beings are self-aware and concerned about their own happiness and the well-being of their communities. We all ask those. So if superheroes help us ask those questions and get a sense of which role models are out there today that are very popular, and we should look at them and ask, are they worthy of admiration? Do they make good role models?
Well, see,
in my book, I don't just cheer on the characters. I take them apart a bit and inspect them. And some of them I criticize really harshly. This isn't 10 superheroes and they're all great. It's 10 superheroes and I'm really rough on most of them.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I was reading the little clip. It said that you take the 10 top superheroes and pit them one against the other chapter by chapter, which is an interesting idea. You're not just,
well, it's one of those things in superhero comics, deal. Whenever superheroes meet each other for the first time, they always fight each other before they go and face the villain together in a team-up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to take that approach to the book as well.
That's a fun idea. Well, I was, when we come back from this break, the one thing we haven't talked about that obviously is a factor is, religious superheroes, if you will, depending on where your belief system is. And when we were kids, we always, that was discussed. I mean, those were things you could talk about, but anymore, you can't talk about even God, just generic God, regardless of how you see God in the world. We're not even allowed to discuss that, and philosophy seems to be something that leads everyone down a dark road. You're not allowed to talk about that either. So I kind of envy you that you get to discuss these things all the time, but this actually gives people a platform to start looking at some of those things where we've sort of made that an evil dialogue. You know, can't talk politics, can't talk religion. Now we can't talk ideas, and on our college campuses, debate is kind of going to the dogs, if you will. So
I do tell my students that it's a real luxury to be able to have a space where people are free to inquire, to try out ideas, to question themselves and each other, to put ideas to the test, and that it is what befits us as free and rational creatures to engage in that activity, even if it makes us uncomfortable, because we don't really get a good sense of why we think what's right is right or what we think is true, unless we engage in the friendly conversation that puts these thoughts to the test. And if you can't have that space in an institution of higher education in a society that's committed to freedom and equality, then you can't have it anywhere, because that would be the place where we most need it.
Right. Yeah. And now it's become a blood sport. Let's continue with that when we come back.
Yeah, because you really don't sound like a college professor to me, but I don't know. We'll get back.
Yeah, we
on
might
that.
Have to post your credentials online. We'll be back with our guest, Travis Smith. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
You call me strong, you call me weak, but still your secrets I will keep. For granted, all the times I never let you down. You stumbled in and bumped your head. If not for me, then you'd be dead. I'd fix you up, put you back on solid ground. If I go crazy, then will you still call me Superman? If I'm alive and well, will you be there holding my hand? I'll keep you by my side with my superhuman might, kryptonite.
Okay, so what do you think about the previous question? I mean, when we were kids, I'm 56, and growing up in Connecticut, we were either Catholic or Jewish. Those were the choices. And I remember sleepover parties, you know, in some other kid's basement. We'd be laying there in our sleeping bags, and we'd be talking about well, if you don't believe in Jesus, who do you think he was? You know, and we would have these conversations as, you know, little kids. I mean, I remember 10 years old, probably. It was an elementary school kid. And we would talk about those kinds of things, you know, and that was kind of a superhero, I guess, discussion. Who did you look up to? Who did you model? But that's all taboo now.
Yeah, when you look,
we don't
at
get to talk about any of that kind of stuff
today.
Now.
You can't, I think to have a conservative view of
yeah, but to even
society,
question anyone's
yeah,
religion.
Exactly,
I mean, you're
you
not
can't,
allowed to
you
do
can't
that.
Question the popular thought anymore. So I'm curious how that's worked out for you and your. I guess in Canada, it's
you are 3,000 miles away from Berkeley, so that is an advantage.
Yes.
Well, I'm a professor of political philosophy. I'm not a theology professor, and so I'm not teaching, say, biblical traditions or other religion in my class. But I am teaching Plato and Aristotle, for example, as I mentioned.
Sure, but on the hero, the concept of hero, right?
Yeah, no, in my classroom, I'm one of those who thinks that it's irresponsible for the professor simply to teach their own point of view. Mm-hmm. When I teach...
What a great idea.
When I teach political philosophy, I do my best with every author that I teach to try to give them a generous reading, to try to understand them as well as I can on their own terms and try to communicate my own best understanding of what they're trying to say and how they're trying to persuade people of their conclusions, so that students are given as fair an understanding of them as possible so that they can start drawing their own conclusions and thinking about them critically without having to simply parrot back to me what they think I think they're supposed to say.
Right, right.
And so when it comes to studying philosophical traditions, that's how I approach it in the classroom, in which a great deal of diversity of views regarding how human beings should live and who should be in charge and those kinds of questions get addressed by multiple authors. And I, that's how I teach those things in the classroom.
So it's not okay in your university, or at least in your class, every time someone has a differing thought, they don't need to run to the room that has puppies and crayons in it? Because that seems to be what's happening out here all the time.
Yeah, no, I don't see that as a problem.
I mean,
it's important to me at the same time to make sure that students know that they're able to express their own views as well. I don't stand for ad hominem attacks. Nobody's supposed to, insult another one of their classmates. But you need to be able to engage in a discussion of ideas that people disagree strongly on and try to make the best case you can for them. And that's what a philosophical discussion should be like.
That's fantastic.
Where do you think it comes from, the current attitude at a lot of these universities where you can't have an alternate view or you're a hater or you're a bigot or whatever? Where did that start? How did we get here? Especially in these universities.
Which bad superhero modeled that?
Well, yeah, the universities used to be the place you went to have, these discussions of political views, right and wrong. But now anymore, there's one view. How did we get there?
I suspect there's a combination of good intentions, that there are people who are genuinely solicitous of trying to make sure that a learning environment is a place in which everybody who participates feels welcome and should be invited to take part in the discussion. And therefore, if people feel like something like ad hominem attacks are silencing them, that is inappropriate in that kind of environment. And insofar as that is a motivation, that's something to appreciate. I mean, we do want to have respectful discourse, but we also need to have discourse. Respect
right.
shouldn't mean silencing. And so it probably is also the case that we not only have people who have these good intentions, we have people who are more calculating and see that if they can impose a certain perspective on things, it gives their perspective, their preferred perspective, power. And so if they can get the upper hand in that fashion, they will take it. But that's again, exactly the kind of thing that rational discourse in a civilized, respectful, free society is supposed to counteract. And so this theme of showing people respect, showing all people respect, I mean, where I teach, I have extremely diverse classrooms, and I'm very grateful for this. I have students that come from all over the world representing pretty much every kind of political and religious tradition. And to me, it's thrilling to be able to talk to people whose experiences are widely varied from those that I've had in my own life. I mean, you know, we can complain about the way things are in our societies here, and, you know, I'm sure this is something that we all can do quite a bit. But when you get to have a conversation with a young person who actually comes from a society that suffers under real tyranny...
Mm-hmm.
That puts everything in perspective. And my ability to have conversations and have those students share their experiences with each other so that, you know, students whose experiences are less varied can find out what it's actually like, say, to live under a totalitarian government that genuinely persecutes people and disappears them is to me, it's important to have. And I like it when students then do disagree with each other regarding their fundamental beliefs, get a chance to share where they're coming from with each other in the class. But, of course, the key to making that happen and for it to be productive is that it has to be done in a fashion in which people are respectful to each other. They do so with civility. There's a certain fear that that disagreement will always devolve into incivility. But that just shows how important it is and how difficult it is to cultivate civility, and that respect isn't just simply something that's easy. Toleration and acceptance of diversity, these are not something that are easy. These are difficult things that we have to put effort into learning how to exercise properly, because we live in very diverse, pluralistic societies, and that's something that actually does have the possibility of producing something beautiful, but that requires civility and respect. In the book, I actually talk about this with discussing characters like Thor and Captain America. Captain America, for example, comes to the rescue of all Americans, no matter who they are, what they look like, or anything. And Captain America, while he, you know, does have a career in punching Nazis, when it comes to helping American citizens, he doesn't, you know, try to look at everybody's social media footprint first to make sure he agrees with them before he comes to their assistance. And if he were to find out that he strongly disagrees with their views, he might let, you know, the agents of Hydra do their worst to them instead. No, he wants to stand up for a conception of equality that shows respect for all of us, despite the fact that we do disagree. And I guess the last point I'd make on that is part of it's related to the question of how much you think politics can accomplish, and how much you think perfect justice is possible. And I think if people expect perfect justice, and if people believe that political powers can solve all problems, then you increasingly leave less and less room for freedom, because more and more power and control has to be exerted in order to engineer the conditions that you believe would satisfy your criteria for justice.
And the expectation of the people in the system goes way down. You know, they're not expected to actually do anything or perform. They're supposed to, you know, they're basically like wild animals, and as long as you don't open the cage door, we'll all be fine.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess if we have no expectation for each other, that sort of
that makes that type of control from the top mandatory.
If we believe that human beings cannot disagree with civility, mm-hmm. if we believe that all there is power, if everything is nothing but a struggle for domination, and all of our relations are conflictual, and every disagreement or difference constitutes an inequality, and inequalities are always unjust and therefore must be stamped out by reducing everybody then of course you have a need for, and then you'll always have people who are glad to step up and be the people who will engineer the conditions under which we'll be controlled, because we can't be entrusted with responsibility for behaving in a civilized and respectful fashion among ourselves and learning that. It is difficult to learn it, but it's preferable for us to have the opportunity to do so, and the opportunities to do so do come at come with challenge, come with difficulty, but rather than being alleviated of it for fear of its being degenerated into the worst forms, I think actually is detrimental to everyone.
Yeah, because it seems like right now we're let's throw over debate and let's just turn it all into the Colosseum. You know, we're going to solve all our problems in the Colosseum. It's like, probably not a good solution. We're going to come back with our guest, Travis Smith. Can you believe we have almost gone through a second hour here? A little unplanned second hour that was very easy to do. We knew he would be a good hostage. We know a good hostage when we hear one. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Uptown got its hustlers, the Bowery got its bumps, 42nd Street got Big Jim, a walker, he a bull-shooting son of a gun. Yeah, he big and dumb as a man can come, but he's stronger than a country horse. And when the bad folks all get together at night, you know they all call Big Jim Ball just because. And they say you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind, you don't pull a mask off an old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim. I don't do that.
Just out to find the better part of me. I'm more than a bird, I'm more than a plane, I'm more than some pretty face beside a train, and it's not easy to be me. I wish that I could cry, fall upon my knees, find a way to lie about a home I'll never see. It may sound absurd, but don't be naive. Even heroes have the right to bleed. I may be disturbed, but won't you concede? Even heroes have the right to dream.
Back. We're here with our guest, Travis Smith, the author of Superhero Ethics. And Bill's been percolating a question for you.
Yeah, we're talking about, obviously superheroes and the struggle. Travis, do you think Hollywood does a fair job of not politicizing the message in a lot of these movies? I think we can all agree a lot of the actors and producers are a little bit left-leaning in Hollywood. Do you think that's reflected in these movies and in the outcome, so to speak, of these superhero struggles?
I think you'd have to take that one movie, one story at a time, and if the movies are done well and the stories are told well, then they should be complex. They should, if they're done well, not just hammer home a single solitary ideological point interminably, that becomes insufferable. Then you're not watching a story, then you're receiving a sermon.
Right.
And sometimes sitting through a 10-minute sermon is hard, but a 2.5-hour-long sermon
right.
is a real challenge.
Yeah, we see that in a lot of the 1 hour, say the 1 hour crime shows.
Grind a point home.
Yeah, they grind on a particular view that is the exact point they want to make.
Have they wrecked any superheroes?
They wrecked any.
Yeah. I mean, did they take like a perfect
turn them into somebody we don't know?
Yeah, they take a perfectly good superhero and just mess them up.
Back in the 90s, they would do some superhero movies, and fans would get really irate that they felt like the characters had been ruined or betrayed or transformed beyond recognition. And starting really with the X-Men movies, I think the first one came out in 2000. The movie studios realized that the smart thing to do is actually be true to the characters as much as possible, mm-hmm. because there's a reason why they have such lasting power, why staying power. There's reasons why they're so beloved. And instead of getting the aggravation of the diehard fans who are disappointed by going off script so far, why don't you get them on board to champion them and show the rest of society why they've been so compelling to this this small fandom for so long. I'm sure if I were to think about it, you'd put me on the spot.
Sorry.
What is interesting to me is, I mentioned before in the first hour about how 10 years ago, unless you're a comic book fan, you didn't know who Iron Man was very, very likely.
Right.
This weekend, Ant-Man and the Wasp is in theaters, and I'm taking my family to see it sometime next week. And there again, characters that have been around since the 60s. But unless you're a comic book reader, you probably don't know who the Ant-Man and the Wasp are. Same thing happened when the Black Panther movie came out earlier this year. He was a character that's also been around since the 60s in the comic books. There's a story called The Rage of the Panther, that is one of the best comic book series told over something like 15 issues back in the day. But until the movie Black Panther comes out to theaters, to a lot of people who are not comic book readers, he must be brand new. Who is this character?
That's a good example of I think what I'm getting at, because I've heard a lot of criticism of that particular movie, that it is sort of a socialistic view of society. And was that the original character?
I wouldn't call it socialistic, though. I wouldn't. I actually have to rewatch it. I got my copy of the DVD for Father's Day, and I haven't sat down to rewatch it. I remember my family and I enjoyed it when we went to the theaters to see it.
Okay.
It is politically complicated, and I think there are things to extract from it that are instructive, as well as things maybe to criticize. And I don't actually cover that book in my I don't actually cover that movie in my book. My book manuscript was sent to the press just as that movie was coming out, but I'm actually looking forward to an opportunity soon to actually publish an article with my thoughts on both the Black Panther movie and the appearances of Wonder Woman in recent movies as well.
Because, yeah, I forgot about her.
Yeah, I think some ideas that are sort of percolating, and I want to sort of think it through carefully and make sure I give them as much of a sort of measured assessment as I try to do with all the characters I deal with in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the promo of the book says that you take the top 10 superheroes, pit them on against the other chapter by chapter. The hero who better exemplifies how we ought to live advances to the final round, and by the end of the book, a single superhero emerges victorious and is crowned most exemplary for our times.
You're not going to ruin it, are you?
Is this a spoiler alert to find out who wins?
Well, my wife is sitting beside me now. She just came in to bring me a glass of water. So let me just say the greatest superhero ever is my wife.
Oh, there you go. Good call.
Yeah. I'm no dummy.
and so does it mess it up if you tell us, if you... how about this?
Well,
okay, you can answer
right.
that question. Okay, you got two questions.
I can put it very simply.
Okay.
I do entertain several characters as potential. And, of course, the book is based on look looking at very well-known characters. If I had written the book about my favorite characters, it would be different.
Right.
You know, my favorite character is not Shazam, but the character who is going to have her own movie that comes out in March of next year. And I'm really hoping that the Marvel Studios get her right like they have so many of the other characters, because she's a really inspirational character. If we're running out of time, I'd go at great length about why I love Captain Marvel so much. But in the book, I do look at a number of alternatives, and I don't mind saying that in the end, there are aspects of the character of Thor that I say, you know what, right now, under the circumstances, in the cultural situation we're in right now, I think he provides in some ways a role model that would be worth considering trying to emulate. But, you know, things shift in the culture, and
yeah.
and which hero you would say right now under the circumstances change, so that can change as well. But in the book, I give some reasons as to why I think there are aspects of the character of Thor. And I wanted to go with, to be honest, I did want to go with a character that was not the conventional answer. Everybody else would always say Superman. Or maybe
yeah.
Spider-Man, or maybe Captain America. And those are all the really obvious, safe answers. So I wanted to, I did have kind of an interest in coming up with something that was counterintuitive or unexpected. And I tried to make a case for why there are aspects of the character of Thor, who, despite having been portrayed as a bit of an oaf in the films, has a sort of real nobility of spirit and in the way in which he interacts with all human beings, that I found consistent with my answer before about what kind of classroom I try to run at the university and how I try to show a really diverse student body how we can learn to disagree with each other with civility and learn from each other while we do so. So I guess those two answers are related to each other.
Okay. And then I guess in closing, your article in the Daily Caller, Can Superheroes Save American Freedom? So without... without going into great detail because we don't have time, but I liked the way you ended that whole article, that if we get sick of, if we become fatigued with superheroes, that speaks volumes about where we are as a society. And I thought, that's pretty interesting, that we wind up feeling helpless and live in fear that we're doomed unless some presumptive savior vanquishes the evildoers and imposes justice on our behalf. I thought... very telling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we don't want to get to that point.
No, we don't. It's funny. So if we keep our eye on the superheroes, we'll know. We'll know if we're in trouble or not, huh?
That's right. Okay.
I like it.
Well, gosh, I'm really glad you stuck around for another hour, because we don't have a third hour, or we'd probably try to Shanghai you again.
Your wife's like, I told you so. I told you there was enough to talk about.
Well, I've really enjoyed this, Bill. And Aaron, thanks so much for having me on We the People Radio. This has been a real pleasure.
Well, we'd love to have you back after the book's been out a while and give us kind of an update on how it's doing.
I would be available for a future conversation. That would be wonderful.
Great.
Thanks a lot. All right. Have a great Sunday, what's left of it. Our guest has been Travis Smith, author of Superhero Ethics. You've been listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.